This Janet Mefford Today podcast is sponsored by Heart for Lebanon, the Christian ministry working among 2 million Syrian refugee families who've been displaced. For just $29 a month, you can help Heart for Lebanon reach out in Jesus' name to a family of six, providing them with food, Christian education, survival essentials, and the gospel. Please call now, 888-247-5499. That's 888-247-5499 or janetmefford.com.
This is Janet Mefford Today.
Our confidence is in Christ alone.
Are we going to stand with God, come what may?
If the Word of God says it, I believe it.
And that's the way it is.
And now, here is Janet Mefford.
Welcome, everybody. Great to have you with us again. I want to start out talking a little bit about this CNN Equality Town Hall with a few general observations before we dive into the details on all of this. The general observations are this. How many town halls do you need to put the Democrat presidential candidate hopefuls through on a subject related to a sexuality that affects roughly 3 to 4% of the American population? Because they've already had two now. Two presidential forums specifically focused on homosexuality and transgenderism. Why? Well, the answer has nothing to do with whether or not there is some pressing political reason for it, although we know that Big Gay is all in for the Equality Act and they just want to oppress Americans more and more and more who dissent with them on where they stand regarding marriage and every other issue under the sun that they want to push to further their agenda. So you have two town halls. Think about this for a moment. Who controls you? When you have two town halls on this narrow of a subject, which really isn't a narrow subject anymore, and that's a little bit the point I'm making. This has become not some cry like it was back in the 80s and 90s for tolerance. It's not some cry for we want to have equality necessarily. Now it's just we want total domination. They should have called it the domination town hall because that's really what it's stacking up to be. It really is. Secondly, my other general observation is this. CNN co-hosted this town hall with the Human Rights Campaign. Now, think about this for a moment. The Human Rights Campaign is this uber-rich, biggest homosexual lobby group in the entire world. The Human Rights Campaign, I would argue, has more power than almost any lobbying group. I know people will point to groups like the NRA and others and so forth. I understand there are a lot of powerful lobbying groups, but as far as the left is concerned, I'm hard-pressed to name a lobbying group or an activist group with more power than the Human Rights Campaign. Can you imagine any TV network in the United States of America co-hosting a presidential forum with Christian pro-family activists? This isn't just a matter of they want to cover the subject at a presidential town hall. They're teaming up with big gay activists. They are activists. CNN. We know CNN are activists. We've seen it over and over and over and over again. But I find that groundbreakingly horrifying. Because they would never do it on the other side. Hey, CNN, why don't you co-host a town hall on Christian family values with the Family Research Council? Yeah, that'll happen. That'll never happen. And what bothers me about both of these generalities is the fact that this is a group that has an outsized influence, unlike anything maybe other than Planned Parenthood. It's stunning to me. So let's dive into this. The big news from the Equality Town Hall co-hosted by CNN and the Human Rights Campaign was this horrible moment from Beto O'Rourke. Now, by the way, Beto O'Rourke has absolutely no chance of getting the nomination to the presidency. So we don't have to worry about him. And in order to distinguish himself from the rest of the candidates, he's just been going further and further and further, not even left, but to Saturn. I mean, I don't know what else to call it. This guy is, he's completely nuts. I think he would say absolutely anything to distinguish himself from the pack. And he kind of did. Listen to cut one.
This is from your LGBTQ plan. And here's what you write. This is a quote. Freedom of religion is a fundamental right, but it should not be used to discriminate. Do you think religious institutions like colleges, churches, charities, should they lose their tax exempt status if they oppose same-sex marriage?
Yes. There can be no reward
no benefit, no tax break for anyone or any institution, any organization in America that denies the full human rights and the full civil rights of every single one of us. And so as president, we're going to make that a priority, and we are going to stop those who are infringing upon the human rights of our fellow Americans.
Yeah, there it is. There it is. He thinks it would be fine for churches and Christian colleges and Christian charities to lose their tax-exempt status if they don't go along with redefined marriage, which is no marriage at all. We will be your big brother. You will not get your tax-exempt status if you don't go along with big gay. Now, the bigger issue for me, beyond just Beto trying to distinguish himself as further left than anybody else, is the fact that he got applause for saying that. We would love to strip the churches of their tax-exempt status. We would love to strip the Christian colleges and charities of their tax-exempt status. They want us gone. Do you understand that? There are two options from the far-left activist wing of this entire movement. And the reason I say that is because there are people out there who are practicing homosexuals who don't go along with all of this radicalism. And we know that. I'm not defending homosexuality in any way, but there are people who do not go this far. So I want to always distinguish between the far-left radical big gay activists and people who may be in the lifestyle but not agreeing with the politics on this. They want two things to happen. One is they want all the churches and the universities that have the name Christian on them to become completely pro-homosexual, pro-transgender, pro-big gay agenda. That's it. And for the ones who will not capitulate, they want them gone. That's it. That's their agenda. You will not be able to get away from the Borg. We will assimilate you, or we will destroy you. And I'm not saying destroy in physical terms. I'm not saying there will be any sort of necessarily physical repercussions, certainly not at this juncture. And I don't want to prognosticate that there ever would be, God forbid. But I am saying you're seeing your freedoms just stripped away. And the freedoms that they can't strip away from you, they're talking about stripping away from you and applauding the idea. You can't do it, first of all, because it's a total violation of the First Amendment. The idiocy of that remark is just appalling to me. Beto O'Rourke knows better. Well, maybe he doesn't. I probably shouldn't give him that sort of credit. But he knows we have a First Amendment, and we do not have any sort of problem with the separation of church and state on the left when they want to make sure you don't have any Christian prayers in school. That's fine. Separation of church and state. Oh, they don't mind it if you have kids bringing in Bibles and sharing the Bible or reading the Bible or sharing the gospel with their classmates during a school time, you know, whether it's a class or lunch or recess or what have you. Oh, Freedom From Religion Foundation will just swoop in and nail that kid to the wall. They have no problem. In fact, they're big, big supporters of separation of church and state, which we know is not in the Constitution, but it's from the Danbury Baptist Letter, Thomas Jefferson. We know all of that. They're all for it as long as it benefits them and gives them some kind of excuse to shut up Christians. But if it works the other way, where there's a separation of church and state, and we rightly say, hey, state, you can't infringe upon the church, then all of a sudden, all bets are off. What is this idea that if we don't believe the idea that two men can be married, which is absurd and offensive, I'm sorry, but it still is. It's morally offensive to say that. How is that denying full human rights and full civil rights to anybody? You got your Obergefell decision, Beto and company. You know, what happened to that? You got equality. Love won. So where's the love? Where's the love? I don't see any love. I see more jackbooted thuggery going on. We want to stamp you out, Christians. You will do what we want you to do, or we will make you do it. He's not going to be able to do it, at least not yet. I never know what the future holds. We are so far off the reservation in a post-Obergefell world, it seems to me at any juncture, anything is possible. So I really don't want to say, oh, it'll never come to that. I don't say that anymore. Because, you know, half the stuff that's happening now, when those of us 5-6 years ago were saying, you know, if you open the door to this, you're going to get this and this and this. And people laughed and people said, you're crazy. You're nuts. You know, I made a comment. Boy, I don't even know how long ago it was now, but I made some comment, some reference, passing reference to marking out Christians as those who, you know, should be shunned for not going along with the agenda. Oh, they wrote about me. Oh, she's such a crazy nut. I don't sound so crazy now, do I? I really don't think I do. But we're going to come back. There's more to talk about with this equality town hall. Stay with us. You're listening to Janet Mefford today. Hi, this is Janet Mefford. It may be hard for Americans to believe, but there are many people in Lebanon who have never heard anything about Jesus. That's exactly why Heart for Lebanon is there, working in the nation that's currently home to more than 2 million Syrian refugee families who have been displaced through no fault of their own. Every day, Heart for Lebanon is reaching out to these families in Jesus' name, telling them about Him, and providing food, Christian education, and survival essentials. And the Lord is changing lives. One little girl we'll call Shayna was one of those refugee kids who had never heard of Jesus until she entered Heart for Lebanon's educational program. When Shayna was given the assignment to write about a defining moment in her life, she chose to write this. We were in Syria and we knew nothing about Christ the Lord. When we came to Lebanon, I joined Heart for Lebanon school. It is there where I got to know that Jesus Christ is the Savior of the world and that He can save my sins and that whosoever worships Him will have eternal life. And you know what? Shayna learned who Jesus was because someone here in the United States supported the important work of Heart for Lebanon. And you can support them too. Right now, you can help rescue a child like Shayna and her family with food, Christian education, and survival essentials for just 98 cents a day. That's just $29 a month to rescue a family of six. Call now, 888-247-5499. That's 888-247-5499. Or there's a banner to click at janetmefford.com. These families need immediate help. And more than that, they need Jesus Christ. And they need to hear the gospel that can save. Please help the important work of Heart for Lebanon today. Again, that number is 888-247-5499. That's 888-247-5499. Or there's a banner to click at janetmefford.com. Thank you so much for whatever you can do, and God bless you. We are back on Janet Mefford today, talking a little bit more about this CNN Human Rights Campaign Equality Town Hall. Isn't it incredible that a mere 3-4% of the population seems to be calling the shots for the other 95-96%, 97% of the population? Right, because the progressives are all in on everything the big gay agenda wants. Whatever they get, they're getting with the full approval of the progressive movement. In fact, there was an article in The Atlantic with this headline, "At the candidates' LGBTQ town hall, agreeing was the easy part. Now that everyone's a supporter, who wants to be a leader?" Who wants to be a leader? Well, I don't know who will be the leader, but they're really falling all over themselves to express who is more pro-homosexuality and more pro-gay agenda. You know, you would think at some point someone would pull back. And actually, of all people, Buttigieg did. Mayor Pete, good old Mayor Pete, stepped in and kind of quashed a little bit of what Beto had to say about the fact that he thinks that tax exemptions for churches should go away if they don't back so-called same-sex marriage. And Mayor Pete, who was on TV yesterday, I think it was Meet the Press and State of the Union, that's what it was. And he said, "O'Rourke is playing with fire. The idea that you are going to strip churches of their tax exempt status if they haven't found their way toward blessing same-sex marriage." I'm not sure he understood the implications of what he was saying. He disagrees, according to State of the Union, with O'Rourke on using tax-exempt status to reinforce anti-discrimination laws with religious institutions, saying, "I think that's just going to deepen the divisions that we're already experiencing." Well, pardon me for saying I don't trust Mayor Pete as far as I can throw him. I think he's doing something which is trying to differentiate himself, as he has tried to do all along, as the reasonable one in the pack. Well, I'm going to play you a couple cuts in a moment that are going to show you how, quote-unquote, reasonable Mayor Pete is. But first, let's go to Elizabeth Warren, because she had some crazy things to say, as always. And she had yet another lie. Oh, yes. Oh, yes. You know, another day, another lie from Elizabeth Warren. So she was answering this question. Listen to cut two.
Let's say you're on the campaign trail and you're approached.
You have been, yes.
And a supporter approaches you and says, "Senator, I am old-fashioned, and my faith teaches me that marriage is between one man and one woman. What is your response?
Well, I'm going to assume it's a guy who said that. And I'm going to say, then just marry one woman. I'm cool with that. Assuming you can find one.
Well, that was hilarious and everything. Only marry one woman? Does that mean at some point somebody should have the right to marry two women? Who knows? But it's just kind of obnoxious, isn't it? And did you catch in the guy's voice who was posing the question that he kind of threw in a southern accent in the middle of that question? And then he kind of checked himself and stopped doing it. Yeah, they're not caricaturing anybody, are they? And then Chris Cuomo follows up. Listen to this one. Cut three.
You grew up conservative in a conservative household. Uh-huh. You were Republican by party for many years. Yep. Was there ever a time that you felt differently about this issue in particular, about same-sex marriage?
No, I don't think so. I actually don't remember it. I mean, it may have been the case. I don't have notes from when I was a little kid. But I don't. And that's part of it. I mean, to me, it's about what I learned in the church I grew up in. First song I ever remember singing is, they are yellow, black, and white, they are precious in his sight. Jesus loves all the children of the world. And to me...
Can you sing it again?
You bet. You want to harmonize with me on this? But to me, that is the heart of it. That was the basis of the faith that I grew up in. And it truly is about the preciousness of each and every life.
Yeah, sure. Okay. So we're supposed to believe that Elizabeth Warren, growing up in a conservative household years ago, had the same view on same-sex marriage that she has now. There's only one problem with that. There was no concept of same-sex marriage when Elizabeth Warren was little. There was no concept of same-sex marriage until just a few years ago. So we have to go back even to 2008, where no Democrat would even come out in favor politically and publicly for so-called same-sex marriage. It's just a bold-faced lie. Can we say that? Because there's no way. The question was specifically, did you ever feel differently about same-sex marriage? An honest answer would have been, well, there was no such thing. Nobody ever used that phrase, same-sex marriage, when I was a kid. It was just invented a few years ago. Well, she would never say that. They'd probably hurl something at her from the audience. You are a homophobe. But why lie about it? It's so easily debunked. Now, let's get over to Mayor Pete at the LGBTQ Equality Town Hall. So ridiculous. Anyway, this is a question posed to Mayor Pete on the issue of homosexuals donating blood. Listen to cut four.
Current FDA blood donation policy prohibits gay men who have been sexually active in the past 12 months from donating blood. When tragedy hits and blood donations are desperately needed, many gay men are unable to donate simply because they're in a relationship with a partner of the same sex. Would you support a shorter deferral window? And what would your administration do to allow someone like me to be able to donate blood when it's needed?
First of all, thanks for what you do to keep your community safe. And so many people want to take that extra step and contribute literally a life-saving means to help others. In South Bend, we run a mayor's office blood drive. It's one of the things that we've traditionally done. And I inherited it when I became mayor. And I remember the moment when I realized that, unlike most initiatives that I spearhead, I can't lead by example on this one because my blood's not welcome in this country. And it's not based on science. It's based on prejudice.
Oh, my goodness. My blood's not welcome in this country. It's not your blood that's the problem per se, Mayor Pete, and you know that. This is just such a politically crafted answer. The reason that those bans are in place and the restrictions are in place is because of the potential of transmission of HIV. We all know that, and we know this is based on hard evidence via the CDC. You can go on the CDC website and look up the rates of HIV for MSM, which is an acronym that stands for men who have sex with men. There are reasons, health reasons, that this is in place. And they made this big point of saying, oh, this is outdated. We've now got new drugs and so forth. But to say that it was discriminatory and my blood's not welcome in this country, again, it's kind of the civil rights language. The only reason is because they're homophobic. Well, that isn't true. It's not because they're homophobic. It's because of the potential for passing on a potentially deadly disease to people who need blood. And why would you risk putting anybody with any kind of potential problem in their blood and risk that blood being donated to somebody? I mean, come on. This is not hard. I don't even know why I have to explain this. But, you know, it's not society's fault, is it? Well, probably. It probably is society's fault in the view of Mayor Pete, because we're just horrible and we probably should have our tax exemptions taken away, according to Beto. We're just awful people. Another dumb moment for Mayor Pete. This one was incredible. Listen to Cut 5.
I'm very mindful of the fact that my experience as a gay man, but as a white cisgender gay man, means that there are dimensions, for example, of what it's like to be a black trans woman that I do not personally understand. But I also think the diversity within the LGBTQ plus community is part of what we have to offer right now. Our community, our country is so torn apart. We're so fragmented. And here we have the LGBTQ plus world that is everywhere. We are in every state, every community, whether folks realize it or not, we're in every family. And that means we can also have the power to build bridges. And when somebody is weighing whether to come out or just coming to terms with who they are, it's really important for them to know that they're going to be accepted. There is no right or wrong way to be gay, to be queer, to be trans. And I hope that our own community, even as we struggle to define what our identity means, defines it in a way that lets everybody know that they belong among us.
What is this gobbledygook? Think about this for a moment. This is the level of discourse that is now acceptable rhetoric and is not even laughed off stage with the Democrat Party. This is presidential level discourse. You know, as a white cisgendered male who's homosexual, I can't possibly identify with the experience of a black trans man. What are you talking about? It's nonsense. It's intersectionality. Whatever happened to saying, hey, how's South Bend doing? How's your violence rate in South Bend? Not so good, is it? Hey, they're calling for your resignation in South Bend because of the whole controversy over the police. What about that, Mayor Pete? Oh, no, I'm so intersectional. Let me tell you how intersectional I am. You know, I cannot really explain how much I care about black trans women. Yeah, it's ridiculous. And by the way, when he brings in the whole argument about society being fragmented and our diversity in the gay community is what we have to offer people. You know something? First of all, the fragmentation in large measure is caused by your community in terms of your activism. Not all the people in the community, but the activists. You know, when you go around suing Christians like Jack Phillips and going after Baron L. Stutzman and driving Aaron and Melissa Klein out of business in their bakery in Oregon and going after Kim Davis and going after this person, that person, getting this person fired and that person fired and that person losing his business. Who's causing the fragmentation? Why don't you just leave people alone? Look at your coexist bumper sticker on the back of your Prius and remember that if you're going to coexist, that means you coexist with everybody, even people who disagree with you. That's what made America great is free speech, freedom of religion, the ability for all of us to self-autonomy. Instead, you're going around banning therapy for people who are sexually abused and have unwanted same-sex attraction. Maybe if you guys led the way on getting rid of the fragmentation and you quit going after people, maybe there would be a little bit better world we could live in. But this isn't what it's all about. And in fact, it's all about power, more and more and more and more and more political power. And by golly, they've got it, because now the Human Rights Campaign is co-hosting presidential forums with CNN. What a joke. The media is a joke. This entire presidential race, I think, completely jumped the shark after Thursday night. We're going to come back right after this. Stay with us. This Janet Mefford Today podcast is sponsored by Heart for Lebanon, the Christian ministry working among 2 million Syrian refugee families who've been displaced. For just $29 a month, you can help Heart for Lebanon reach out in Jesus' name to a family of six, providing them with food, Christian education, survival essentials, and the gospel. Please call now, 888-247-5499. That's 888-247-5499 or janetmefford.com. We are back on Janet Meffer today. When we think of the atrocities of the Holocaust under Nazi Germany, we think of Adolf Hitler or Heinrich Himmler and Joseph Goebbels. But among the worst of the Nazis was a man you've probably never heard of. His name was General Hans Kammler, and he was declared dead after the war, having been said to have committed suicide. But did he really commit suicide? And what did the U.S. government know about Kammler? It's a major untold story that required a huge investigation, and we're going to talk about it today with Dean Reuter, who is General Counsel, Vice President, and Director of the Practice Groups of the Federalist Society for Law and Public Policy. He's here today to talk about his book, The Hidden Nazi: The Untold Story of America's Deal with the Devil. Dean, it's great to have you with us. Thank you so much for being here.
Well, thank you for having me on, Janet. I really appreciate it.
Oh, well, this is fascinating. I have to confess, I never heard of this guy. Tell us a little bit about Hans Kammler. I've never really heard anything about him.
Well, you're in the vast majority of people who have never heard about him. Even students of the Second World War just don't know about Hans Kammler, primarily, as you suggest, because a German court adjudicated him dead at the end of the war, and everyone bought into his suicide. Yet he was among the most powerful and most wicked of all the ardent Nazis in wartime. By training, he was an architect and an engineer. He had an undergraduate degree and a PhD. He became a family man with eventually five children, but initially was involved in just civic engineering projects, roadways, buildings, things like that. However, before the war, he had been involved in designing slave labor and implementing that sort of policy, the use of the healthiest among the prisoners as slaves. But then as the Holocaust began to get underway, it was Hans Kammler who chose Auschwitz as the site for the main camp. He chose other campsites as well. And then he designed these camps, the meets and bounds, the railways, the roadways, and then installed the gas chambers and the ovens. And he did this in a hands-on way. I mean, he's not sort of at a safe bureaucratic distance. He was right there in the thick of things, barking orders, demanding changes, even firing his pistol in the air to move his subordinates to greater action. And the people that worked for him and his colleagues feared that he'd have them executed. I mean, he was just an irredeemably bad guy.
Oh, it sounds that way. Did he have any direct hand in murdering any of the people who were victims of the Holocaust, or was his role mainly relegated to, you know, the engineering and creating the camps?
No, he was that hands-on, unfortunately. I mean, he was not marching people into the gas chambers he designed, but he was making sure they were built not just at Auschwitz but throughout the Reich. He designed the concentration camps, barracks, and, you know, there's a drawing we have. It's an architectural drawing that shows the concentration camps barracks. And in the margin, 550 people are to be crammed into one single small building. And that number is written, there's a strike of a pen through that number, and it's overwritten with the number 774. So just like that, he increases human misery in those barracks by 30%. And that certainly caused the deaths of thousands, tens of thousands of people.
That's unthinkable.
Even more directly, you know, he ended up being in charge of all of Germany's secret weapons. And at the production plant for the V-2 rocket, the famous German V-2 rocket, he was there once. There were some folks that were sought out as saboteurs. These were slaves working in this underground cavernous facility. Kammler suspected there had been sabotage. And as an example, just to make an example, he picked out 30 people and had them hung in front of the rest of the workers in a demonstration of just brutal, raw power and madness, frankly.
Good grief. How did you come to be interested in investigating more about his life? As you say, the narrative is that he committed suicide after the war. But when you look at the documentation, you discover, no, he was not actually a victim of suicide. It was way worse than that.
Right. Well, that's a great story in and of itself. And I wrote this book in the first person. There's a couple researchers who were helpful in this, and they ended up being on the cover as my co-authors. One of these researchers I've known for 30 years since college, and he came to me 10 years ago asking me to write a collaboration agreement. I'm a lawyer, so as a friend, he asked me to write a collaboration agreement so that he could share the fruits of his researcher with our other author, Colm Lowry. They didn't know each other at the time. They met in a World War II forum online and realized they were both researching the same person and decided to work together. So I drafted that instrument with them. And, you know, then Keith Chester started feeding me information and telling me about this all-powerful, all-wicked Nazi general. And I was, you know, I brought a lawyer's skepticism to the project. I couldn't believe it. And to me, there's no way somebody of such vast power had never been written about and had escaped justice completely. But these guys did not believe the party line. Once we got to know and do the biographical research on Kamler, the idea of a suicide just didn't fit with his personality at all. He was not the kind of guy to give up or to give in. And we knew that he controlled the rocket team, the German rocket team. We knew the German rocket team ended up in the United States. And then we found, you know, more and more evidence indicating a deal between Kamler and the United States government. But that deal just didn't make sense, a deal to save his own life. It didn't make sense if there had been a suicide. So we kept digging and digging and digging, and we were able to disprove the suicide because he was alive, at least 10 months after the suicide.
Well, when you say the U.S. government was in cahoots with him and he was in U.S. custody for months after the war ended, were they complicit in putting out this false narrative that he actually committed suicide? And why did they want him? Why in the world wouldn't they want to put him on trial?
Well, they wanted him because they wanted the German rocket team. The German rockets, the vengeance weapons, were so sophisticated and so far advanced, they were 15 years ahead of anybody else in the field. They were building rockets that our scientists thought could not be made. They didn't think they were physically possible to be made. And those rockets got us to the moon and helped us win the Cold War because it became our ICBM. So this was vital information, and Kamler had access to it. As we dug and dug and dug, we saw that fully 8 months before the war, Kamler was in touch with the Americans, and he was laying the groundwork for this deal because everybody knew Germany was going to lose the war, and Russia was going to be the existential threat. We, the Americans, needed to have those rockets, and there was one sure way to get them, and that was through Hans Kamler. So he was able to basically trade his life, rehabilitate himself, for the technology he could bring to the table.
Now, that's a complicated question in some ways, because if that led to the development of the ICBM missiles, that, you know, we had technology that we needed, and everybody can talk about the importance of that. But what are your feelings about that deal that was cut? Was that a deal that should have been cut in your view, or do you think he should have been put on trial, the Nuremberg trials, and suffered the same fate as the other Nazi war criminals? How do you see it?
Well, that's a great question, and I do explore that in The Hidden Nazi, in the book. I get to the underlying moral question, and, it's tough to put yourself in other people's shoes. It's tough to appreciate the context, but in the end, I feel like I would have probably made the same deal in the moment. You know, Russia was going to be the existential threat. They were the ones that could obliterate the United States. And it was clear that Russia wanted world domination in a way Germany didn't. And the Nazis, we recruited a bunch of Nazis at the end of the war because they had been fighting the Soviets, and they knew their weaknesses. They had intelligence networks set up all over Europe that we could and did exploit. So it is a complicated sort of moral calculation. But, you know, I'm very reluctant to try and second guess those folks, knowing that I think I might have done the same thing.
Yeah, no, I totally understand that. And yet it's odd, isn't it, that barely anybody knows this man's name because of it? You know, that's a name people ought to know. Look at what he did.
So I agree with that entirely. Even though we did this deal, even though I think it was the right deal to make, I think there should be sunshine on this process, that we should know about the details of this, who was involved, what their thinking was, how this came to pass.
Yeah.
Just a full airing of the event.
No doubt about it. Well, we're going to take a very quick break. We'll come back with Dean Reuter, The Hidden Nazi, The Untold Story of America's Deal with the Devil is the book, and we'll return right after this. You're listening to Janet Meffer Today. There's been a leftist takeover within conservative Christianity. Ungodly socialist ideas are coming to prominence. Ideas like social justice, critical race theory, and cultural Marxism. And leading figures within mainstream evangelicalism are showing themselves to be untrustworthy as shepherds and guardians of the truth. If you're a Christian who wants to know what to do about this serious shift away from biblical truth, then I invite you to join me at the upcoming Stand Against Marxism conference, taking place October 18th and 19th in Des Moines, Iowa. Hosted by the Enemies Within the Church Project, the Stand Against Marxism conference will inform you about this dangerous infiltration of postmodern thought, connect you with other concerned Christians, and teach you how to defend biblical Christianity in your own church. Register now for the Stand Against Marxism conference, October 18th and 19th in Des Moines, Iowa. For more information, you can visit standagainstmarxism.com. That's standagainstmarxism.com. See you there. Are you among the millions of Americans who feel uncertain when it comes to your health care? As a Christian, are you looking for health care that doesn't violate your morals and convictions? Well, we're happy to inform you that there is a solution, and that solution is Liberty HealthShare. Liberty HealthShare is a community of like-minded Christians who work together to pay for their medical costs. It allows you to decide how, when, and where you will access health care so you can make the best choice for you and your family. Starting at $199 a month for a single, up to $529 a month for a family. That's mom, dad, and all the kids. This is how healthcare should be. For more information, call 855-585-4237 or visit lightyourliberty.com. That's lightyourliberty.com and regain control over your healthcare costs. 855-585-4237 or lightyourliberty.com. Together, we're changing healthcare for good. Welcome back to Janet Mefford Today. Great to have you here and great to be talking with Dean Reuter, General Counsel, Vice President, and Director of the Practice Groups of the Federalist Society for Law and Public Policy and author of The Hidden Nazi, The Untold Story of America's Deal with the Devil. It outlines what happened to General Hans Kammler and fills in a lot of the details that most of us have no idea about because most of us don't even know who Hans Kammler was. And this is a really great book for finding out more on this subject and what he was really up to and his role during the Holocaust. You know, part of what I think is so interesting, Dean, in your book is as you're telling the story of how you conducted the investigation, you actually met with his son. And I thought that was a really interesting story. Can you talk a little bit about how you pulled that off and what you learned from his son? I know that was not the easiest of interviews that you conducted with him.
It was not. You're right. It was really sort of gave me goosebumps. I had been in touch with his son. This is his adult son by now. Of course, he's an older man. Jörg Kammler, the German name for George, frankly. I had been in touch with him by email and tried to arrange a meeting. He lives in near Bremen in northern Germany. He was intermittently responsive, never agreed to a meeting. I happened to be in Germany, so I just decided I would take the train ride and risk showing up unannounced. You know, there's a good chance he wouldn't be at home or he wouldn't see me at all. He was at home. I managed to get into the room with him. He was in a hospital bed, not doing well at all. And I sat with him for quite a while, talking to him about his father and his father's legacy and his father's ultimate fate. His mother, you know, Kammler's wife, the mother of the family, had Kammler declared dead by a German court in 1948 because she was able to get benefits after that. But it was clear to me that the family never really was at peace with the idea that the father committed suicide. They never believed it. They kept asking, even after this adjudication of death, they kept trying to get information on what had happened to their father. Even when I was in the room with this guy, he wanted to know what I knew about the ultimate fate of their father. Did I know? Could I prove that he survived, that his suicide was faked?
That's interesting. Well, you know, it's probably not his favorite subject to talk about his father, given what his father actually did. But then you also, I know, talked to a man named Joe Gringlas, who is, what, a survivor of both Auschwitz and Dora, which you say is quite unusual.
Very unusual. I mean, it really is. Auschwitz was the camp that one of the camps that Kammler helped build. Dora was a camp that Kammler built from the ground up using slave labor. And it's the place that housed the German rocket team near the end of the war. It was the largest underground factory ever built, and it was built on the backs of, you know, 35,000 slaves. The estimates are that 25,000 of those slaves perished in the building of this. So Joe Gringlas, 17 years old at the time, first goes to a ghetto. He's from Poland. Then he's shipped to Auschwitz, where he, as a 17-year-old, he faces down Joseph Mengele. He survives that selection process where, you know, some people are going to be killed outright at the gas chambers if they're not strong and able-bodied. He managed to convince Mengele, you know, he could be a laborer. So he survives Auschwitz. Then he's shipped to Dora and survives Dora until it was liberated in mid-1945 at the end of the war. Mm. And I just happened to find him through a sequence of events that I describe in The Hidden Nazi. It was just good fortune to be able to meet him. And he's just a fantastic story. And his attitude on life, even today, is just it's remarkable to me to see somebody like that who survived that and just has such a positive attitude about life.
Yeah, that is incredible. Did he have any ability to shed any light on Kamler, additional light that helped you with your investigation?
He really didn't. You know, this is one of those circumstances where you can imagine walking into a huge corporation and never meeting the boss.
Yeah.
It was sort of like that. However, he could very readily describe the conditions that Kamler established within the camp and the conditions all the slaves had to endure. And that was, you know, incredibly useful.
That's incredible. So you say, actually, that he was preparing for the Fourth Reich. I mean, that's stunning. A Fourth Reich. The third was bad enough, but a fourth one. So what did you learn about that, what Kamler was up to in trying to move in that direction? What are the details on that?
Well, so, I was skeptical of this when Keith and Cohn brought this up, the possibility of a Fourth Reich. It just sounded like the stuff of fiction to me. But we found proof that the German government was meeting German government officials were meeting with German industrialists and businessmen in the fall of 1945, so 8 months or so before the war ends. They have this high-level meeting, and they direct all these German businesses to offshore all their assets, get all their gold, all their banknotes, all their technology to safety outside the Reich, because we're going to lose the war. And we want to preserve that for later, for a resurgence for the Fourth Reich. Mm-hmm. So that meeting happened, and folks followed through on that. The math shows that, you know, Germany exported more gold than it owned at the beginning of the war. So they were a total net gold exporter during the war, especially towards the end of the war. And then we found a fascinating 1953 CIA report on the goings-on in South America, describing German enclaves down there, populations, pockets of Germans by the tens of thousands, with lots of technology, wealth, German markets, German Chamber of Commerce, German churches, everything, soup to nuts. And the authors of the CIA report were direly afraid of the possible resurgence of a Fourth Reich.
Goodness. What ultimately became of Kamler? How did he die?
Well, in The Hidden Nazi, the book, we spin out a couple different scenarios. We know he didn't die in May of 1945. We know he lived in American custody and was interrogated for at least 10 months. And then we spin out three different scenarios, and we support them, you know, why we think each one is less or more likely, and give the evidence we have for each one. And that's how the book concludes. And really, it's my hope that somebody's going to read this book, hear this guy's name, remember that their grandfather mentioned him or their uncle or something like that, and find a box of documents in their attic. The state of records from World War II is really, really astounding. They're not very well organized. But somebody out there has more information on this guy. If they read this book, I think they're going to be clued into something that will help provide, you know, some missing pieces of the puzzle.
Oh, yeah. Well, you must have some remaining questions then. What would those be? What would be your most pressing remaining questions about Kamler?
probably what was his ultimate fate. We know we had him for 10 months. There's a British extradition request. I think it's possible that he went to the Brits, that they tried him sort of secretly and maybe executed him. I don't think that's likely, but I think most likely is he went to South America. But I would love to know for sure. I would love to see, you know, the written document that says this is Hans Kammler's, you know, gravestone.
Yeah. Yeah. Who knows what ultimately became of him. But you're right. Maybe somebody has a box of documents in their attic and they can provide some further information that will get you toward that ultimate answer. Was there any truth to the rumor that he worked in the Soviet occupation zone of Germany? Because that was one thing that I read about that was a potential reality. Did you find any evidence of that at all?
We did not, and that cuts contrary to everything else we know about him. You know, he came of age during World War One, a war that Germany suddenly lost. His father fought in that war as an anti-communist. Kammler was an anti-communist, ardent anti-communist. He even himself fought in the Eastern Border Defenses, Hans Kammler did shortly after World War One. I don't think he would have done everything he could to not go over to the Soviets. And the paperwork we have him signing orders twice moving this rocket team, hundreds of men and women, rocket scientists that we ended up with. But in order for us to get them, Kammler had to sign orders to move that rocket team twice, both times to keep them away from the Soviets.
Wow.
So all of that conflicts with the idea that he went over to the Soviets.
Well, when you talk about the rocket team, how big was the rocket team, and were they all part of this group that was in U.S. custody?
Not all of the rocket team came to the United States. I think Bob Hope joked, you know, we got to the moon first because our Nazi scientists were better than the Soviet Nazi scientists. So we got the best. We got the cream of the crop. We didn't get all of them. Yeah. And the rocket team at Peenemünde, at the rocket site, there were thousands of folks involved. Not all of them rocket scientists, but as we lay out in the book, The Hidden Nazi, the rockets were so sophisticated. They involved so many different disciplines and so many different pieces of technology that you needed all sorts of expertise.
Yeah.
And all sorts of fields represented.
Good grief. Well, you can read all about it in The Hidden Nazi, The Untold Story of America's Deal with the Devil by Dean Reuter, who's been kind enough to join us. And such a fascinating book, Dean. Great job, and really enjoyed talking to you. Thank you so much for being with us today.
Thank you so much for having me on, Janet.
Oh, it's my honor. God bless you. Thank you. And thank you for joining us on Janet Mefford Today. Always a pleasure to have you, and we'll see you next time.